Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Melissa Daggett, who's the author of a fascinating new book, Spiritualism in 19th Century New Orleans, The Life and Times of Henry Louis Ray. We'll also talk with Allison Alsop and Tom Andes about the New Orleans Writers Workshop, and Roger Kamenetz will talk about dreams. Historian Melissa Daggett teaches at San Jacinto College in Pasadena, Texas, and she'll be a guest at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival in March to talk about her very interesting book, Spiritualism in 19th Century New Orleans, The Life and Times of Henry Louis Ray. She'll even be part of a seance, only in New Orleans. Melissa Daggett, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So how did you first become interested in spiritualism?
Well, it's sort of a long and winding road. It began in 2004 when I started on a second master's program at the University of New Orleans. And as part of the program, I had to work on some graduate papers. So I looked for a topic that would be both interesting and a topic that would be original. So I eventually ended up at the archives at the University of New Orleans at the Earl K. Long Library. And the archivist told me, well, we have this great collection. It's the seance registers. And so, of course, I was all excited. But then he said, well, the problem is all of it's in French, and most people can't read French. But it was a good situation for me because I'm fluent in French. So I wasn't really looking to get involved in spiritualism, but that's where I ended up. So after that, I worked on some graduate papers, and those evolved into a thesis. It was interrupted for a while by Hurricane Katrina, but I did manage to come back to it, and I did manage to graduate from the University of New Orleans. So after that, I had been encouraged by several people to write a book about it, and I spent several years researching spiritualism, not only in New Orleans, but around the country, and then eventually got it into a manuscript, and then later on, the University Press in Mississippi published it. And just recently, I got my own copy, and so it was just a thrill to actually hold on to the physical copy of the book after a decade of work.
Well, that's such a serendipitous story, because sometimes an archivist is the writer's best friend, you know, when it comes to history, because they know what they have that hasn't been used. And these were fairly extraordinary records. I wonder if you'd describe them.
Well, first of all, it's 35 registers. And when I say registers, I'm talking about very large books. The leader of the seance circle was a man named Henry Louis Ray, and his profession was an accountant. He worked at several different hardware stores. So apparently he somehow or another got some of the register books. And the registers are filled with many, many pages of transcriptions of the seances. And they're in the form of a letter. You have the exact date, and then it's like a message to maybe an individual in the circle or maybe the circle in general. And then it's signed, I mean, not actually by the spirit, but there's a signature, the person who had the message, who wrote the message. And it could possibly be more than one person. So Henry Louis Ray kept track of these transcriptions, and at the front of the register, he had an index. Now, typically the index is at the end of a book, but in this case it was at the beginning of the book, and he listed all the names of the people that had the spirit messengers. He had all the names, he had the page numbers. It could be more than one message, and it often was. And that's basically the format of the registers. So like I said, there were 35 of them, beginning in 1858, and terminating in 1877.
Now, spiritualism was a movement that was really sweeping the country at that time, and yet folks don't seem to usually associate it, as far as I know, with New Orleans. When it arrived here, it really seemed to find fertile ground.
Oh, definitely. There were several reasons for that. First of all, New Orleans was a large metropolitan city, and also it was different from the rest of the South. It was sort of like an island in a sea of conservatism. And people were also receptive to different type of religions, different type of people, more so than the rest of the South. And one other thing is people in the New Orleans were more receptive to religions that communicated with the dead. Of course, the most famous one would be voodoo. But there were other things as well. There was mesmerism in the 1840s, and the leadership under that one was Joseph Barthes. He was a French emigre. So that was popular for a while in the 1840s. And, of course, we have the famous haunted houses, especially the one on Royal Street, Madame Lalaurie. And I do have an interesting quote. This dates from 1858. So I'm going to read the quote because I just love this quote. "If there is one city in our universe that the spirits of the departed are in abundance hovering over, anxious for its conversion, it is New Orleans." And I think a lot of our present-day residents would agree with that.
So true. So tell us a little bit about Henry Louis Ray himself. He lived from 1831 to 1894. But I was so fascinated to hear that he started off as a bookbinder.
Well, he started out as a bookbinder. I don't really have much information about that. But his main occupation was accountant for a hardware store. So we know that he worked at a hardware store like in the mid-1850s. And then during the Civil War, he was actually a captain in the Confederate Army. This was a black unit called the Native Guards. That's the role that he's most famous for. That particular unit later on transformed into a unit for the Union. And after the war was over, he became involved in politics at the state level. He was a representative in the state legislature. And then still later, he was the 3rd District Tax Assessor. And then he went back to being in the hardware store, and that was around 1877. And he stayed in that same position for years until he died in 1894.
And we should say, of course, that he was a free person of color.
Yes.
And a lot of this book illuminates the lives of free people of color during that period.
Yes.
Well, for a long time, I think people dismissed spiritualism as kind of quackery, but now historians such as yourself are starting to take this much more seriously. So what do you think accounts for that change? Why are we willing now to reconsider it more seriously?
Well, I think people maybe are looking for answers. We're in a turbulent period of time, and when that happens, people look at non-mainstream type of religions. So that may be it.
So I'm curious, what are your plans for this seance at the Tennessee Williams Festival?
It's going to be at the Herma Grima House on Thursday, March the 23rd in the afternoon. They didn't want to do it at night because they thought that might be too spooky. But I'm going to be lecturing a little bit on 19th century spiritualism. And I have a friend who is going to team up and do a reenactment of a seance at the Herma Grima House. So we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll get some spirits.
That would be a lot of fun if Henry Louis Ray surfaced and brought your book to life.
Yeah, that should be interesting.
Oh, it'll be a lot of fun. We've been talking with Melissa Daggett, whose new book is Spiritualism in 19th Century New Orleans, The Life and Times of Henry Louis Ray. You can meet her Thursday, March 23rd at 3:30 at Herman Grima House, and she'll also be on a panel March 24th at 10 a.m. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for reservations and information. Melissa, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you.
If you've made a commitment to your writing this year, and if you're looking for a writing workshop, there are several wonderful options for you. Today, we'll be talking with Allison Alsop and Tom Andes, who, along with Jessica Kinnison and Anya Groner, are creating the New Orleans Writers Workshop. Both Allison and Tom are widely published and met while they were teaching at the Loyola Writing Institute. Allison is the co-author of The French Quarter Drinking Companion, as well as fiction and nonfiction about food and cocktails. Tom Andes Hobbies is a Loyola graduate himself and has a great love of crime fiction. His work has appeared in Best American Mystery Stories as well as many other publications. Allison, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having us.
You too, Tom.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
So for the shy writer, just starting out, you know, an environment like this, Tom, tell us a little bit about your philosophy of teaching.
We always try to make the workshops as supportive as they can possibly be. I think we both remember the sort of the vulnerability of working really hard on something and then putting that in front of the classroom and sort of to be judged by a sort of a tribunal of your peers. One of the things I will try to do, I always sort of joke with my students about this, is when they do a response to a story, I've always been one of those students who, like, I talk way too much and I dominate the conversation in the classroom. So I always try to structure the class so that when it comes to responding to a story, everybody's on the spot for 1 or 2 minutes and everybody has to respond because we go around in a circle to respond to each other's work. And as far as the stories themselves and putting people's stories in front of the workshop, I just try from day one to create an environment where it's supportive and where it's clear that we're going to look at your work on its own terms.
So tell us about what you hope to offer at the New Orleans Writers Workshops. What are the topics you're going to cover, for example?
Well, we're going to have a variety of classes in our beginning debut starting this March. We'll have classes in fiction, in nonfiction, and also in poetry. And then we're going to as well offer practical workshops on the weekend that are going to be more targeted towards specific points of craft or process.
And you're going to be offering them all over town. So what are some of the places so people will have a chance to think about it?
We're going to do classes on the Tulane campus uptown. We'll have classes at the Antenna Gallery downtown. We're going to have a class, and we're calling it Reading for Writers, and it's basically a class about how to approach fiction, how the way you have to read changes when you're writing, and we're going to do that at Tubby and Coo's Bookshop in Mid-City. And we're going to have a class on the North Shore that David Armand, who's a terrific writer, I'm sure lots of your listeners know. Yeah, he's going to teach a class on the North Shore. We're really lucky to have that. So we're trying to cover all the sort of major areas of the city and then the greater New Orleans region as well.
So you're saying that you're offering classes and events for all different ranges of skill. How are you going to evaluate the levels of skill of your students? How are you going to put together these classes?
I've had a really interesting experience in the workshops I've taught so far, and particularly in the community workshops I've taught as opposed to the academic workshops I've taught, where people really seem to meet each other at the level they're at. And from day one, if you try to establish the idea that, you know, first of all, we're all sort of here together, we're all on the same team, nobody's sort of gunning to be the top dog in the class, but we're all here to sort of lift each other up at whatever level we're at. And if you emphasize the idea that I want to help you write the best story that you can write, but it's going to be your story and not my story. And I think if you emphasize those things, I've really found that people really meet each other on their level. And so you'll have stories that, you know, sometimes you can tell from the first page or two of a story, somebody's still figuring out like how to format dialogue. Sometimes you have stories that are really terrific. And if somebody polishes a couple scenes, they could probably send it to a literary magazine. And I think you sort of learned intuitively to recognize where something is when you receive it and then accordingly respond to it appropriately.
I think it's wonderful about having community-based classes and having writing workshops from people who are generally, for the most part, professional adults who have outside lives outside of writing, is they're all coming to it as writers. They're really all coming to it as comrades. Everyone is really after the same goal. And so having it in this non-academic or non-traditional setting means that you're not really evaluating writing in the way that you would in a traditional classroom, but you're really trying to help each writer to achieve his or her own vision. And students really begin to meld together and come together and support one another. Even if they begin as strangers, as the weeks go by, they really form quite close bonds. And it feels very supportive in that way. It's not so much about evaluation, I would say, as about encouragement and giving specific feedback to help students achieve what they want to in each story.
I think people bring enormous goodwill to these things in the first place, because if they're willing to display their own vulnerability, they're going to be kinder to other people. And I think that a lot of people They may want to be writers and professional writers, but life doesn't allow them the luxury of committing to a creative writing program. And so they look often desperately for something just like this. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this goes over time for you all. Because I think there are a million writers here in New Orleans, you know. All you have to do is open a door and you find a writer. Another thing you're going to do is offer lots of information about the business aspects of writing and practical information as well. So how will you do that?
In our classes, we have been able to incorporate aspects of publishing, tips and advice. So for those writers who feel like they're ready to take that next step, whether or not that is to submit to a literary magazine, or they have a novel or a book-length work that they want to find an agent, or perhaps go to a conference and make these sorts of contacts, that's going to be part of the ongoing discussion that we have. So not just having the feedback and the support in the community, but also practical advice of how you can take this to the next step and find that audience.
And you have some other things on the horizon as well, right, Tom?
We're talking about adding editorial services, manuscript consultations, manuscript critiques. It's basically kind of tailored one-on-one feedback. Either it can be for shorter stories, like if somebody has a story or an essay they want to look at. It could also be for a book-length work. And those services range from something like a consultational or a critique would be maybe for like a newer draft of something for larger picture feedback. Editing is going to be a closer reading that might involve some specific revisions, and proofreading will be more sort of fine tuning when something is basically almost ready for publication.
So that's great because people can get really individualized instruction for wherever they are
Yes.
in this process. And you have this wonderful partnership with the Dogfish Reading Series, which enriches everything, you know, literary life in New Orleans, but will enrich these course offerings as well. So what are the plans for that collaboration?
Dogfish is a really great series that Jessica and some of her colleagues and friends have been organizing. I think it offers two things to our students. One is that it offers them the chance to show up and they can basically hang out with people they're in class with. They can meet people who are in other classes. It's fellowship, it's community, it's a beautiful space. There's an open mic afterwards they can sign up for so they can road test their material if they're feeling adventurous and if they want to do that. And then most of the features at Dogfish are, first of all, most of them are terrific writers. And also most of them tend to be, you know, maybe they have a book, maybe they don't have a book yet, but they're publishing a lot. A lot of them tend to be people who are starting out. And I think it makes literature, I think, like a living thing for people. And you can come and you can participate in it and you can talk to the people who are making it and doing it, as opposed to something that's just in an anthology or a textbook or even just a book you find in the store where it's a little bit more dry or removed.
And it's also just great for having the opportunity to perform in a space for your students as well. And that's such a comforting, welcoming space and environment for something like that. Well, this is going to be so exciting. I can't wait to see how it all works out. We've been talking with Allison Alsup and Tom Andes, who along with Jessica Kinnison and Anya Groner are creating the New Orleans Writers Workshop. For information about tuition, registration, and schedules, check out neworleanswriters.com. Allison, Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a hoot.
Thank you. I've been so glad to be here.
Roger Kamenetz is the author of 11 books of poetry and prose, including the best-selling The Jew and the Lotus and The History of Last Night's Dream, which Oprah Winfrey featured on her Soul series. He is Professor Emeritus of English and Religious Studies at LSU, where he founded the MFA in Creative Writing and the Jewish Studies minor. He's been working with dream clients one-on-one and in groups since 2003. Today, we're talking about a special talk and workshop he'll be doing with Marion Gay at the School for Contemplative Living at Parker United Methodist Church. Roger, welcome back.
Susan, so nice to see you.
So, The History of Last Night's Dream, I know I tell you this every time I see you, but it's such a powerful book. Every time I read it, I start to dream and remember my dreams. You must have heard this from a lot of people.
I do hear that, and that's fascinating to me. I think it's because they're long discussions, presentations of dreams, and just thinking about dreams, thinking about others and your own makes you dream.
And that book has changed your life in so many ways. I mean, you have become so focused on dreams now, and your next book will be about dreams. Am I right?
Right. I'm working on dreams and the poetic imagination and the interaction between dreams and poetry and trying to create a field guide to dreams, to the natural dream, as I call it.
So tell us about this lecture you'll be doing. You're going to do this whole workshop and lecture the 24th and 25th of March.
So the talk is called Dreams in the Sacred Encounter, and Marion's going to do a demonstration on contemplations that she's been taught in her dreams. So I think that's a great combination. And then on the next day, we're doing a workshop. So basically, I'm jumping off from an essay by W.H. Auden, the British poet. And when he became the Oxford poet, he talked about the primary imagination as a realm of sacred encounter, where we meet sacred objects or images and sacred beings. So I feel like dreams are that also. They're a field of primary imagination, not just for poets, but for everyone. And the big signal of the sacred encounter is often terror.
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, Roger.
Right.
I'm going to have nightmares.
Exactly. Well,
thanks a lot.
Well, we all
I think of all those biblical dreams.
Right. I mean, we all have experiences. There's a sort of spectrum of feeling from, you might call, simple fear to terror to wonder to awe. And they're all in a sort of spectrum or range of feeling. And I think all of them are kind of like Geiger counter signals that I might be in the presence of a sacred object or a sacred person or animal.
Or animal, yes.
Yeah.
You said something really wonderful that I read. That you said that not everyone can be a great poet, but everybody can be a great dreamer.
That's true.
So how do you become a great dreamer?
Well, pay attention. I think we're throwing away billions of dreams every night worldwide. I've been writing mine down for a long time. And then you get to look at them again. The great thing about remembering your dreams is they take you right back to these places. So some of the experiences are incredibly difficult. Some of them are incredibly beautiful. But to carry them with you and to, say, during the day, dip into them for a moment is refreshing.
So you're going to do this workshop with 10 or so people, and they're going to be sharing their dreams.
Right.
And that's a very personal and often difficult thing. So you ask people to write their dreams down and send them in advance.
Not too far in advance these days. I used to study them up, but now I like to be much more spontaneous. I'm kind of like a mechanic who doesn't, I haven't had much book training. I pick up the hood and I look around and say, oh, that oil can looks dirty and that horn, we don't even need it. And we're just kind of fooling around a little bit, but by playing and moving around and sort of slowing things down or bringing people's attention to what I call the event in the dream.
Mm-hmm.
Or the sacred object, the object that carries, the sacred is, I don't even know if that's the right word, but it's an image or a person that carries a tremendous amount of feeling. So you know it, you really know it.
Yeah. So do the people who come to workshops like this and events that you've done, and when you ask them to write down their dreams and bring them,
mm-hmm.
do they often say that's a new experience for them? Do they often talk about the writing of the dream as something different?
I think most of the people have done some of this before they get involved with this kind of work, but the experience of writing down a dream is really interesting because something's happening there also, isn't it? You know,
mm-hmm.
I find that they're so challenging to my abilities to write. I mean, I find that dreams really, things happen. I see things. I know what they are, but I don't know what the words are. And it's actually kind of fun to try to write down a dream.
And to remember. I sometimes have trouble remembering every detail, and I know there's something there, you know?
I have trouble remembering every detail of every day. But,
well, that's true, too.
But some of them are so amazing, you know, and you do wake up with a sense of wonder or terror.
I'm curious, because I know you are collecting dreams and writing about dreams. How does this work with your life as a poet? It's got to be hand in hand in so many ways, but is one more appealing to you than the other at this moment?
Well, what I like about working with people is I feel I'm helping them and I mm-hmm. can see change in their lives and some wonderful changes. So that's really moving to me. I think with poetry, it's always been an exploration of images and words, language together. And it's a deep root for me. It's sort of the way I understand things, you know. And I think also poetry is what evolved me from this 15-year-old kid banging away on his typewriter because his parents couldn't understand him. And writing gibberish to kind of wherever, you know,
right.
If that hadn't begun that process of poetry, I would have become a different person.
And don't you find that dreams are particularly useful for writers?
Yes, they are. I think dreams have a lot to teach poets, and poetry has a lot to teach dreams. I say they sort of inform each other. But what I think is extraordinary about drawing on dreams is it focuses more on imagery and less on what we call the discursive, that is talk about stuff,
right,
and takes you right to the heart of images. So when I do workshops like dreams and poetry workshops, I'll be doing that at the poetry festival that's coming up, we'll take a person's dream, one person, but everyone will write a poem based on the encounter or the incredible image, and they all come out different.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
It seems like the dreamer should get to take all that writing home with them.
Well, only if we get to take their dream home with us.
Right. Well, we've been talking with Roger Kamenetz, author of The History of Last Night's Dream, who'll be giving a lecture Friday, March 24th at 7, and conducting a workshop with Marion Gay Saturday, March 25th. For registration and tuition information, as well as more information about the School for Contemplative Living, visit their website at thescl.net. Both of these events take place at Parker United Methodist Church. For more information about the work of Roger Kamenetz and Marion Gay, visit the naturaldream.com site and kamenetz.com. And you can also catch Roger at the New Orleans Poetry Festival speaking about dreams and poetry, Saturday, April 22nd at 11 o'clock. Roger, thank you so much.
Susan, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Serge Parogère signs Cold Hot, A Visual Journey, photos of musical culture throughout the southeastern United States, Tuesday, February 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. To learn more about the classes offered at the New Orleans Writers' Workshop and our guests, Allison Alsop and Tom Andes, check out neworleanswriters.com. And coming up, the Friends of the Terrebonne Parish Public Library sponsor the 14th Annual Jambalaya Writers Conference, set for March 4th at the Terrebonne Parish Main Library in Houma. Writers across all genres will guide both new and practiced writers in their craft. This year features Lisa Unger, Jeff Lindsay, author of the Dexter novels, Rachel Kane, romance writers Alexandria Weiss and Farah Roshan, Roland Paris of Marvel Comics, My Sunshine Away author Emma Walsh, Nicholas Maneri, Ashley Elston, Elise Arden, Kim Vosdeville, and many more. Poetry and fiction contest submissions are due by February 10th, and for more information or to register, go to mytpl.org. Meg Wolitzer, whose most recent novel is The Interestings, will be the Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence March 6th through 9th at the Newcomb College Institute at Tulane University. She will present a reading and sit for an interview with Tulane professor Molly Pulda, Monday, March 6th at 7 at the Kindle Cram Room in the Lavin Burning Center. And later on in March, get ready for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 22nd through 26th, with special guests Jamie Attenberg, Roy Blunt Jr., Rick Bragg, Patricia Bosworth, Robert Olin Butler, Dick Cavett, Amy Dickinson, Wally Lamb, and many others. Masterclasses start on March 23rd, so sign up for limited admission events with some of your favorite writers. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. The schedule is online now. For more information about Roger Kamenetz and Marion Gay and their DreamWork workshop, visit the School for Contemplative Living's website at thescl.net or check out thenaturaldream.com or kamenetz.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.